Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, media, and the environment. And every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and well-being and the total health environment. What's going on in our communities? What's going on in our society? What's going on in our earth, water, air, and I think I said earth already. Okay. What's going on in our world and what's going on that's really affecting our beliefs, our attitudes, and the choices we make as a society? Most importantly, what's going on with the ecology of planet Earth? Are we aware? Are we engaged? Are we protecting all that we hold dear and that's necessary for our health and well-being? This is what we talk about every week on Connect the Dots. Every week, I feature different experts, authors, advocates, filmmakers, doctors, thought leaders, and a whole bunch of interesting people that address different facets of what the show covers, which obviously is very broad. So glad that you're with us today, listeners, because we really have a great and fascinating show for you today. I was just, the moment I heard about this very exciting film and the wonderful filmmaker who's producing it, I wanted to bring it on to the show, even though the film is not yet available for release, because the topic is so important, fascinating, and in keeping with all we talk about here on the program. So today I'm delighted to welcome to Connect the Dots Jen Senko. She is a director, producer, and writer, an award-winning documentary filmmaker based in New York City. She's produced a host of award-winning documentaries. Several of the titles that you may or may not know are Roadmap Warrior Women, which is really a great title, The Vanishing City, which exposes the policies and economic philosophy that has made New York a city for the rich. That's a very connect-the-dots topic. It's gotten a lot of awards and mentions and is played all over the world as well as in New York City. But we're here to talk about her next film, which is a work in progress. You'll be able to see it hopefully later this year, early next year. And it's already kind of making the rounds of certain festivals. Once you hear what it's about, you will be as fascinated to see it and learn more about it. And today we're going to be talking about the content of the film, her progress in making it as a filmmaker, and also connect you so that you can know when the film is coming out and you can see it, and we may do a catch-up program at that time as well. The film that Jen is making is called The Brainwashing of My Dad. The subtitle is The Truth Behind the Right-Wing Media Machine That Changed a Father and the Nation. Well, listeners, I think we know what we're talking about. Can't wait to delve into this. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Jen Senko.
Thanks for having me, Allison. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's really, as someone who has been in the media myself for 25 years, mm-hmm. I have been an observer, participant, and eyewitness of all that goes on in that world. Over the time that I've been working professionally in the media, it's kind of used to be just kind of like this seamless machine where we sort of gave it tremendous authority and trusted everything that was told to us. And now with alternative media and other, and just events that are going on in our society at this time, more and more people have both participated in the media as well as become more critical. And I think that we can always increase our media literacy and awareness and sort of ask, how did I come to think this? What influenced me to think it, believe it? And whom do I trust as an authority? What kind of questions should I ask to become more skeptical? And this is the territory that The Brainwashing of My Dad is all about. And, of course, it's also a very personal story. Would you tell our listeners a little bit about your father and, what happened with him?
Sure. My dad, we grew up, a non-political, like Kennedy Democrat family. And then my dad had a commute with like a lot of guys in a carpool. And then one day my parents moved and he had a longer commute to work and it was solo. So he turned on the radio, and instead of listening to music, he found talk stations. And the major talk radio person at that time was Bob Grant, and I don't know if people have heard of him or not, but he was, you know, openly called like a bombastic racist radio host at that time. And very slowly, my dad started to change. And I remember feeling this unease. Like, I felt like I could see the writing on the wall. Nobody else in my family at that time really gave it that much thought or paid that much attention to it. But, you know, over years, then eventually he found Rush Limbaugh. Excuse me. And then, oh, sorry about the frog in my throat. Then he had a friend who turned him on to Fox News. And so this became his world. And he used to have his, what I called his Limbaugh lunches, where he would close himself off in the kitchen and listen to Rush Limbaugh and eat his lunch for 3 hours. And he even had Fox News on at the same time. But he would mute Fox when Rush was on, because Rush was his preferred I was going to say poison, his preferred listen. And what our family found was that he changed radically from this non-political, easygoing, open, very open person to he got radicalized. It wasn't just that he became a Republican. So what if he did? That would have been one thing. But he became an advocate for every far-right issue there was. And
how disturbing. I'm going to just interrupt for a second.
Sure.
And give you an opportunity to take a little sip of water. And mm-hmm. and also just, you know, the other thing that I'm hearing in what you're saying is that here was somebody who was, you know, participating with his work colleagues, he was participating with his family, and so not only does he begin to listen to this media, but he begins to isolate around listening to this media, and it becomes, you know, a high priority for him, and so there is both a refocusing of his, you know, sort of social relational energy from the people that he actually knows, you know, and his closest family members, mm-hmm. to, you know, these strangers who are kind of hectoring and all of that, telling him how to think and whatever else.
That's right.
Yeah, that's very disturbing. I mean, how did your family, I mean, how long did it take before your family, you know, kind of noticed this?
Really, it's hard to say, but I'd say maybe 10 years, but he became evangelical about it. Mm-hmm. When email came in, he started sending everybody emails. My cousin's husband counted, and within 2 years, he sent 394 emails. So
wow.
It's not just radio and TV. It's pervasive. It's all these emails that also look like they're from real people and they're real stories, but they're, you know, they're really not. They're meant to be propaganda. So my family, it started really not tearing up the whole family, but people, my mother, both my brothers kept saying, you know, we're going to block you. This is, we don't want this. Please stop. And he never sent any personal emails. Never. Never. It was always these political emails, and we all hated it. And one brother blocked him. I ended up blocking him for years. And what happened is my mother ended up sort of answering him back. Actually, it was kind of funny because he sat in the same room, in the same, like, office, back to back on their computers. And my mom would, like, became the researcher. mm-hmm. and would look things up, you know, and send him something back, negating what he just sent. But it never did any good. But it was almost like we lost our dad for those years.
Yeah, it sounds that way. How many years did this take place over?
15.
Wow.
15 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so young. And around what age was he when he began doing this?
You know, it's all kind of blurry in my mind. I think that he was probably in his mid to later 60s when it started.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then
he was kind of beginning to be retired, and he had kind of time on his hands. Is that what
happened?
That's
right.
Or?
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. The Rush Limbaugh happened after he retired. You know, that's how he could have the 3-hour lunches and just, you know, drink beer, belch, and listen to Rush Limbaugh and eat lunch.
So this filled the time that had formerly been occupied. It filled a kind of gap. And, it's probably directed to that kind of audience. Now, here's the thing, you know, one of the things that we do as Americans is kind of go, he must have had some personal problem, yada-da-da. And, of course, you know, personal problems, we all have them, they abound. I mean, you know, there's no shortage of them. But, I mean, is this an uncommon occurrence? Was this, you know, obviously there are many people listening to these programs. In your view and from your research and filming and everything that, you know, you've undertaken, was this a rare situation, a rare case, what he was going through?
That's a very, very, very important question. You know, when I started finding things out, like about the Roger Ailes memo in 1970, you know, sort of like a precursor for Fox, and then the Powell memo, and then the Fairness Doctrine, and the tumbling
of
the...
Let's bring that in later, because I think
I'm going to know what we're talking about.
But
right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But what I'm saying is that once I found those things out and started looking at it that way, then I said to myself, okay, I got to make a film about this, and I got to figure this out. So what happened is I had a Kickstarter campaign, and people were just coming out of the woodwork saying, oh, my God, that happened to my dad, that happened to my mom, that happened to my brother, that happened to my sister. We no longer speak. They'll no longer speak to me. You know, and then I started doing interviews with all these people, Skype interviews, and I had, like, the really sad stories. Like, one girl dated outside her race, and her father said, I just can never talk to you again, ever, because I'm conservative now, and you're not. So... that's when I realized, like, this is a phenomenon approaching it, like almost like an epidemic. So it's very pervasive, and I think it has torn families apart all across the country. You know, and I feel it's even divided the country. When I was growing up, I was, you know, we knew Republicans, they were neighbors, and there was just not this big tension between them. You know, now it's this huge, you're on that side, oh, you're on this side.
Yeah, so in other words, this was kind of this kind of media and the people who were recruited into it became, you know, participants in and foot soldiers of this tremendous divide that we observe in our country, and that's, you know, very harsh and not something that, you know, we really have seen before, which is something I think it's harder for, you know, young people to understand, you know, like how recent this kind of situation is, and it has led to and has created a stalemate in government, a stalemate around handling, you know, the kinds of major issues and societal decisions we need to handle. It's created divisive conversations around a range of issues, guns, race, on and on. Maybe you'd like to add some. I mean, I'd love your thoughts on that.
on what else it's created issues out of. Well, that's interesting that you say that because a couple, you know, well, a couple, quite a few people we interviewed said that there was no safe subject anymore. That they, they, you know, they couldn't like get together with a family. They couldn't talk about the weather because it, you know, it would turn into climate change. They couldn't go visit, you know, like a history museum because they would say, you know, well, no, it said the world is only 6,000 years old, and it be, you know, nothing was a safe subject. So it really, the divide was very great, and people are like, there's a lot of hostility. And what I have found is that, and I know some people won't like me saying this, but it's always pretty much those who hold those really radical right-wing beliefs that have it front and foremost. Like, my dad would always try and bring up politics and find out where somebody was, you know, wherever he went. And that's what I've found with people I meet. I, you know, I engage with people. A lot of my, you know, maybe more liberal friends don't want to bother to engage, but I'll engage and ask questions and stuff like that. But usually that is for, the first thing. That's the first thing on their mind. Like it's it, you know, like I was saying before, it's almost evangelical. They and like you were saying, like foot soldiers. So it's got.
Do
kind
you
of
think
a
it has
thing.
Driven people who don't agree toward social engagement in politics or away from it?
Oh, those who get sucked into it, it's definitely driven them towards. I mean, the.
But what about people who don't agree with these views? You know, what is the effect upon the people who don't hold these views? Do they seek to mirror this by participating more, or does it tend to kind of, they tend to more avoid it and sort of shy away because of this?
I found it to be mixed, but mostly it tends to pump people up. So, you know, you have people who are maybe confronted at work and hear, you know, the what's the propaganda that's put out by, you know, Fox or Rush Limbaugh or any of these people, and they find that they want answers. So maybe they'll go and look for alternative media. So I find mostly that everyone is a little bit more politicized. I mean, you still have some people that just don't, are to consider themselves not political at all, but the opinions are out there. They're like out there, you know, like the wind is out there. So you'll hear somebody say, repeat something, and they're not very political, but it was something that maybe started in the right-wing echo chamber, and just it gets picked up. And, you know, especially with the emails, like I used to work in a law office, and it was pretty much everybody there were Democrats, but you would get these emails sent to you around the office, you know, and people like, oh, my gosh, isn't that terrible? You know, like one of them was like about the woman who had her who sued McDonald's for the hot coffee burns, you know, and it would get everybody like all mad at trial lawyers. And, you know, then it turns out if you've seen the documentary Hot Coffee, like she had to have 9 skin grafts. So you know, it I find that it gets just people in general like more pumped up and more angry, if that makes sense.
It does. Now let's you know, that does make a lot of sense, and thank you, you know, for that. I mean, let's also talk about, you know, after this happened to your father as it was happening, you began to investigate where this right-wing media that was influencing him, what the origins of it were, and you talked to different media experts in the film about where this all comes from and what its intent is and what its effect has been over the time that this has been evolving. I mean, now it's just kind of almost like a fact of life, but, you know, it kind of came from somewhere, and it's sort of instructive to know where it came from. What did you find out? What did you learn when you looked into that?
Well, I started when Clinton was elected. I started feeling like back in the 80s, when it was Reagan, and I wasn't very political then at all myself. I didn't think politics were important until I left New York and came back 4 years later, and when Reagan was president, and I saw all these people on the street homeless, and I said, "Holy crap! If politics do matter." And so I noticed, I felt like the country was really shifting to the right. It's more something I intuited, you know what I mean? It was something I could feel because I didn't have a lot of, like, hard facts or anything like that. I just felt that the country was moving to the right, and it was like a tidal wave, like it was just going. That was the path that it was going in. So, very slowly I started, like, reading more and paying more attention and watching political documentaries. I think one of the first ones that I saw was The Hunting of the President, which was which David Brock was in, and, you know, he was a right-wing political operative at one time. Now he's the founder of Media Matters. And he admitted that he was assigned to help bring down President Clinton no matter what it took. And that's, like, when I saw that, I was like, oh my gosh, you know, I was right. There's like this really strong movement. And and then Hillary said, there's a vast right wing conspiracy. And that's kind of, what it felt like to me. So I wanted to see what else was out there, and I just became attracted to political documentaries and books, and I forget how I found out about it, but I found out, maybe it was through a documentary, maybe it was just through reading, about Roger Ailes and this memo that he wrote.
Now, who is Roger Ailes?
Okay, Roger Ailes is who created Fox News. Rupert Murdoch hired him to create Fox News. He was actually Nixon's television advisor. When Nixon had this had a debate with Kennedy, it was like one of the first times that TV was, the candidates were on TV, and he was all sweaty and nervous, and here John Kennedy was handsome and smooth and had good makeup.
I'm just going to interrupt you for a second.
Oh, sure.
It sounds like your phone is breaking up. I don't know if you could stand nearer to whatever, or if you're not as close as before, because there's kind of a breaking up thing. So, sorry to have to say that. But let me just sort of jump ahead a little bit on our story here. So Roger Ailes is who basically founded Fox News. And so in a single description, how would you kind of characterize him? He's a media operative? Is he a advisor? You know, how would you just without going into the whole history of it, just give a quick sense of who he is?
Sure. Well, he's an expert in television manipulation.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, he...
And he founded Fox News.
Well, Rupert Murdoch came to him and said, "I want you to create Fox News." And so, basically, it was based on this memo that he had written back in the 70s, which was like a precursor to it, which, was like having a media station just for the right, to put out right-wing ideas and avoid... any conflicting ideas.
Okay, so this was his concept, and basically Rupert Murdoch put wheels under it.
Right.
So what is different about Fox News, you know, from news as we knew it before? And now that, of course, the media environment has changed, there are probably a lot of people who don't even understand what the difference was. So, but, you know, how, what is the big difference, the innovation that Fox News brought in when it started?
Well, in a word, sure. In a word, Fox News is mostly opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And that changed from years ago when you had people like Cronkite and Brinkley. It was objectivity. But they started complaining about the liberal media, the liberal media, the liberal media. So, you know, I'm putting that out. So then they were able to tilt the way media was approached, to tilt about to balance, to one of balance. So, you know, suddenly, like, everybody's trying to be balanced. And that, and so you may have a concept that is, like, really well-researched and happens to be maybe a little left, and then you may have a concept that is a little right, but it's not well researched, but it's presented as if it's the same, just because you have balance. So Fox News is different because it's openly biased, and it's you know, it's opinion, and it uses all these emotions and color and images. It's really, it shows Roger Ailes' genius. I mean, he was a genius in TV. You know, he understood the medium and, you know, just created this 24/7 machine that because it is emotional, and it does become addictive, especially to older people, you know, who don't maybe have that much to do. And that was a complaint I got from people, too, is, oh, they have it on all the time, 24/7 in the background, and it's really loud because they can't hear. That's basically how it's different. It doesn't really, even if you like Fox News, you got to admit, like, it's, they're saying their opinions. Oh, this is terrible. That's terrible. You know, and it fear mongers. It's, you know, pushes fear, and tries to get people angry and upset, and makes people feel also like they are your friends. You know, Fox and Friends. And it spills over into other media. You know, if they start pushing a story like, what was it, the no-go zones, right, a while back, you know, saying that there was parts of France that were just Muslim rule, you know, then CNN picks that up and starts reporting it because they figure, oh, well, you know, it's, hey, Fox says it. And so it spills over into other media, and it affects other media, and other media also try to lean further right because they see how successful Fox News is. I hope I'm not going on too much.
No, well, that's fine. So let's just drill into the no-go zones. They were saying there are specific areas in France that were under Muslim rule, and that meant that others could not go there. Therefore, it's called no-go. Now, what is the truth of that? When, you know, and you're saying other media actually just kind of assumed that they had researched the story, it was accurate, it was getting attention, and so they just kind of copycatted and picked it up. Was this true?
No, it was not true at all. And France actually got really mad at them, and I don't know what happened, but they were talking about suing them. There was no such thing as no-go zones. I even know people that were in those areas at the time, sitting, like, having coffees outside, and there just was no such thing. It was just totally made up. It wasn't true at all. Period.
And that's what you mean by fear-mongering. So it portrays a world where, you know, there are scary people that that, you know, will exclude you, and they're running parts of a beloved country, and the same thing could potentially happen here. And this might be extremely frightening to people who have fears or concepts about Muslims, who've never met any, who've never perhaps traveled, or, you know, don't, like, have any other picture of the world. It suddenly, you know, it creates this sense of encroachment, you know, where people feel imperiled, and none of it is true. So on the one hand, you know, this is where accuracy in reporting goes out the window, stroke one. And stroke two, fear replaces it. And things that are just completely patently false replace it. Mm-hmm. And so suddenly everyone is in a debate with something that is not verifiable, that is false, and yet has, because of this, ails or, you know, snappy presentation, you know, dramatic or emotionally gut-wrenching presentation, has made it into the media and gained attention and created a controversy or a belief in a number of people that this is going on even when it isn't. Now, you know, obviously most people that are listening to my program or who would naturally gravitate to your film, they're not going to be followers of Fox News. Mm-hmm. And so the tendency would be, well, this is BS and this is terrible, it's happening, but, you know, we have to dismiss it. What you're pointing out is it can't so readily be dismissed, and it's also, you know, it's infiltrating both our country and many people's families as well. So it's not just, I mean, for some of us, you know, it could be our family members, it could be our neighbors, it could be our colleagues, it could be service providers in the community to which we belong, it could be voters, you know, right, in our community. So this can't, you know, it's an aberration for sure, you know, but it can't so readily, those who don't agree with these positions are dealing not just with a divisive and sort of angered and fearful population of people that are buying into things that are, like, untrue and unproven and you know, not verifiable. And when they're
voting on that basis.
Yeah, and voting on that basis. So this is kind of, it's a very, you know, disturbing and scary phenomena. Now, in the title of your film, The Brainwashing of My Dad, you know, and I just want to also urge once, and I'll do it again later in the program, urge listeners that you can go to the website for this, The Brainwashing of My Dad, and you can participate and track when the film will be available for you to see it and, you know, kind of be part of that whole phenomenon. But, you know, the other thing, like, let's talk for a minute or two about brainwashing. You know, why is this, why do you hypothesize that this could actually be a form of brainwashing? And what does it mean if it is brainwashing?
I don't know if I can answer that, but I can say that when I first named it that, I got a lot of flack. I mean, even from, like, liberals, like, you can't say that, it's too, you know, hot a word, too controversial. And I was really not using it literally. I was just using it because that's what it felt like. And as it turns out, people really, really, really respond to the name because that's what it feels like. Well, I interviewed neuroscientists. I interviewed an expert on brainwashing, neuroscientist from Oxford, Kathleen Taylor. And to me, I can't believe I've come to this conclusion. I think I maybe even just coming to it recently, I feel my dad was brainwashed. And if you want me to go into why I think that a little bit,
yes,
I
would
can.
Like to hear that. Yep.
Okay. So you know, basically, Kathleen was saying there's two ways that you can think about brainwashing. There's one that's by force, where it's coercive, you know, where it's like psychological torture. You know, people are putting into these situations. They're you know, browbeaten into believing something new. So that's brainwashing by force, you know. And then there's brainwashing by stealth. Which is, it's not so much that they're forced to believe stuff. It's just that all the information that comes to them is like pushing a line, and there's no alternative in terms of the information. So if you control the information that's going into the brain, she says, you know, to a great degree, you control what the brain is going to do in terms of what that person's going to believe. So what's happening then is there also then what the brain does, and I've talked to other scientists, is if some new information comes into the brain that doesn't match the belief that's already there, the brain has this filtration process and mechanism which can reject that. You know, it just it checks the information to see how easily it fits in. You know, and if I have to do a lot of thinking, you know, that's just not going to happen. You know, so the neural circuits of your brain only, you know, allow you to understand what fits in. So, okay, there's like five different kinds of really important
factors. I'm just going to restate that because of the fact that we're having a little bit of a technical problem here. So, and this is, I just want a second, you know, the health reporter, this is very well established. You know, we think we're having an open debate, but in fact, people believe what they are capable or shaped to believe. And if it doesn't match their belief, however that belief was gathered, they will reject it, you know. And so actually, you know, this is so if we think we're having an open conversation where, you know, different things can, you know, we can look at the facts together, whatever, that isn't always the case because our beliefs actually shape what we're able to perceive and understand. And if something runs counter to that, we'll have a lot of trouble, you know, going for that. And, you know, and it's actually with more of the noise and sort of up-leveling of media conversation, you know, it's easy to see how hard it is to kind of mediate these kinds of disagreements, you know, in fact. So, yeah, go forward from there. I'm sorry.
Right.
I just was hearing you were breaking up, and it's a very important understanding. I wanted to make sure our listeners got it.
Thanks, Alison. I appreciate that. I don't know why it's breaking up because I'm on the landline, but anyway.
That's strange.
Yeah. So there's five factors, you know, that kind of influence brainwashing or create, you know, this kind of belief change. You know, isolation, you know, so you're cutting people off from other sources of information. Control, so that the brainwasher or the agency, you know, whatever it is, has control of the information that's going in. You have uncertainty, so the brainwasher or the brainwashing agency, whatever, is going to, like, attack their former beliefs. You know, to leave the person unsure of their former beliefs and stir up a state of not knowing what's right and what's wrong about what they truly believe. Then there's repetition, you know, and boy, that's one thing the right wing is really good at, repeating over and over and over. And then the last is the use of strong emotion. You know, that actually can actually be, and anger can actually be addictive, but that's a whole other topic. So if you think about it, like my dad, like a lot of these people, had isolation, you know, control, like all of the information that's going into his brain is coming from, it seems like different sources, but it's all got the same root, you know, the emails, the radio shows. The uncertainty, you know, my dad used to think, you know, black people were fine, you know, but no, you know, then it's the same, you know, the uncertainty, oh, maybe they're not, maybe they're takers, blah, 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 okay, and then the repetition, you know, the repeating from channel to channel to channel, okay, and then the strong emotion. The strong emotion is what really convinces people, these people must be telling the truth because they feel so passionately about it. Oh, my goodness, I believe that. That's how I feel. You know what I mean? They identify with that. So, Yeah.
So in other words, the fact that different people in different media, like you get an email, you hear it on the radio, then you see it on television, and different people are all saying it, it's the repetition, but it also creates the sense that there's a consensus. Here it is coming toward me, and all, you know, of these different groups all believe it. It must be true. So
right.
Actually, you know, that is erroneous because they've all kind of gotten together.
Right. Right.
To do
and
this.
And on top of that, they tell you you can't trust anybody but us,
mm-hmm.
that everybody else is brainwashed. So you've got the pot calling the kettle sooty,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean? So if then the kettle turns around and says, no, but that's what you're doing, then it's kind of like, I know you are, but what am I? You know what I mean?
Well, there's confusion because both, you know, one group is going, it's
right.
the liberal media, and the other group is going, the media is commercially bought. You know, it's like owned by just four or five big conglomerates, and, you know, they report or fail to report on different topics based upon their interest. I mean, you know,
right.
their investment in whether you know about it, support it, or don't know about it. I mean, we've seen this in this last year. I devoted six months of reporting on this radio program to the trade deals, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, Fast Track, and the other trade deals. I've reported on them pretty much from the beginning of 2015, all straight through the year, up until June or so, you know. So, and one of the things that we saw was how, I mean, ultimately, when I began, there was nothing going on about it hardly anywhere. And then as the deals got more in gear, there Bill Moyers and various alternative press weighed in. There was nothing, with the exception of Ed Schultz on MSNBC, there was absolutely nothing about it in the major media or even in liberal media like MSNBC, so which, of course, is owned by Comcast. So the idea that...
Sure, liberal it is.
Yeah, which was actually a participant in sitting at the table during the negotiation of the treaties, because the deals will affect their business and their bottom line, as they will for so many industries. So the assertion, you know, that the liberal media holds sway, and, you know, we have two sides. One side says this, and the other side says it's, you know, one side says it's the right-wing media, which is, in a sense, what you're raising the alarm on, and another side says it's the liberal media. It ain't the liberal media if they're not reporting, you know, on a,
there is,
you know,
no liberal media.
Exactly. Right.
There can't be. I mean, maybe like there's some truly independent media, like you're truly independent, but if all of the media is owned by six corporations, what does that tell you? How liberal can it be? Are the corporations really going to go against their own self-interest? No. It's in their interest to be quote-unquote conservative, and I don't even think of it as conservative. I think of it as it's gotten radical. But again, that's another subject.
Well, they're all interrelated. So what you're really focusing on in the brainwashing of my father is the takeover of the media environment. I mean, you're not describing the right now for a moment. We're talking about the so-called mainstream media, which is not a liberal media, which is operating out of corporate self-interest. But you're discussing something even further than that, which is kind of the advance guard of actively, you know, and irrationally brainwashing segments of the population. And basically giving, I mean, you here are retired people with nothing to do. I mean, there's something, I mean, just to switch gears for a moment, obviously we're not in good shape as citizens in a democracy if our media is functioning as it is in this manner. But also it's terribly poignant that retired people at the time of life where, you know, they could be creating a better world for their grandchildren, giving back, kicking back and enjoying, you know, a time of relaxation and contemplation, are instead recruited to anger and to, you know, this whole thing. I mean, it's really very poignant. I mean, do you think that or is there a particular subset of the population that's most vulnerable to this for other reasons? Or do you think, you know, that anyone could listen to Fox News or, you know, Rush Limbaugh, you know, if they listen to him too much, they're at risk of being converted? I mean, how do you think this is really targeting, you know, a particular group and using that particular group? Or do you think it's almost in the nature of the media itself? I know this is kind of a tricky question, you know, to sort of win over through emotional appeal, you know. And, of course, I just, as a subset, coming from a more progressive kind of reporting, we're not supposed to. If I, you know, overuse emotional appeal to make something more popular or interesting, you know, that's breaking the rules. So, you know, here you've got one side playing by the rules of trying to be fair and objective and document what you report, let people draw their own conclusions, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then that creates a very tilted playing ground, because if in the progressive media, you know, we get indignant or have an indignant headline, then it's kind of like, well, advocacy people are so angry and, mm-hmm. you know, I can't handle that, and, you know, until you're calm, please don't communicate, kind of thing. But yet we have a media environment where gut level, primal, emotional anger and fear of, you know, bigotry and other things are, you know, used to kind of grab and, you know, kind of engage and as you're beginning to think, brainwash people. And, you know, we on the other side have to, you know, kind of document everything, keep our chins high, and never use those kinds of below-the-belt emotional appeals to engage audience. I mean, wow, what a tilted playing field we're on, huh?
Yeah, it is a tilted playing field. And what you said before about the tough question, who are they appealing to, or it's something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
See, I think that people who are older happen to be the perfect audience, because maybe they have more time on their hand. But mm-hmm. unfortunately, I think that it's a problem for anybody that doesn't think deeply, or it's just vulnerable somehow, mm-hmm. you know, and gullible. Like, let me just give you a quick example. When mm-hmm. my mom first heard my dad playing Rush Limbaugh, I mean, eventually mm-hmm. they had to build really strong soundproof doors in the kitchen because she didn't want to hear it. But which is hilarious. But when she first heard Rush Limbaugh, you know, whereas my dad always seemed sort of vulnerable and gullible, you know, and got mm-hmm. sucked in, my mom just said, you know, he doesn't sound nice. He just doesn't sound Christian, you know. And she just said, I don't like it. You know, and she always was a very independent thinker. And so people like my mom aren't going to get sucked in. And nobody wants to think of themselves like, oh, I'm vulnerable, I could get sucked in. But, mm-hmm. you know, that's why you have to make sure, you know, your media is truly diverse. And we have a saying, my brainwashing team, have you fact-checked your media today?
Uh-huh. And, oh, great. Tell us what that means.
Well, there's certain sites you can go to fact-check your media, which I can't remember off the top of my head right now. I should have written it down.
Don't worry about that. What is it?
You just, you know, you hear something, let's say you hear something on Fox, don't go to Breitbart.com to figure out if it's the truth or not. You know, look at a truly independent source, one that's not paid for by a corporation, you know, that doesn't have any stake in the game, and fact check mm-hmm. it. And, you know, everybody was using Snopes at first, right?
That's
and
right.
Then once the right wing started getting busted by them all the time, then they're like, oh, Snopes, oh, they're liberal, oh, they're not this or that. But you know what? They do pretty much bust a lot of these emails, and they're very accurate. So as far as the email front is concerned. Anyway, that's one of our sayings, you know, and at the bottom of our movie, we list just a couple sites, which you probably know, you know, so that you
what
can.
What are they? Go ahead.
I can't remember at the moment.
At the bottom of your site, I'll look for it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, factcheck.org.
Okay, don't worry about it. I'll look for it. I'll look for it online and try to get it to our people. So you're saying that fact-checking, you know, is really critical to being able to debunk, maintain critical thought, you know, discover where things are off. I mean, you know, this whole thing about entertainment value, you know, and gut-level appeal, that also, you know, enters the so-called liberal media, like, you know, MSNBC or whatever, you know, emotional appeals and, you know, stories that people resonate with. I mean, sometimes they're important and sometimes they're just, you know, they're emotional and they, you know, but I often wonder where they're kind of leading us and stuff like that. Do you think this, I mean, obviously this also appeals to young people. I mean, there are younger people, not just people of your dad's generation. What did you find out about the, you know, like the different kinds of people that are get drawn into this thing?
That's where we were going before. Thanks for remembering that. I think I got sidetracked. The alarming thing is that we found that, you know, there were younger people listening to these radio shows or, you know, watching Fox News. And what would happen is maybe their parents or grandparents were listening and would tell them, oh, that's what, you know, if you're watching anything but that, you know, that's liberal media, so watch this, watch that. So I don't think, like a lot of people say, oh, it's just going to die out when these older people die out. It's not going to die out very easily because the formula is there. It's what we have to do is wake people up and to the formula, so that they can recognize manipulation when they see it, you know, and sort of have to go back to objective media. Now, I don't mind MSNBC. I don't – well, it's changing now anyway, and they got rid of Ed, which is a total bummer. But I don't look at it as news. I look at it because I need a relief from, like, right-wing – bias. So it's like, oh, okay, that's, you know, they'll sometimes point out the lies. But I don't look at it as you know, necessarily straight news. Yeah, I forget where I was going with that, but that's it.
So just briefly now, I just want to tell our listeners once again to go to www.thebrainwashingofmydad.com. Where is the film now in terms of, you know, what is its state of production? When do you think it will be released and you know, our listeners can see it? You know, what is its path forward as things stand now?
Well, we have a work in progress that we did show at Traverse City, which was Michael Moore's film festival in Michigan. And because people really want to see it, we're going to run that same work in progress at a couple different film festivals coming up. The Dallas Film Festival is coming up in October. A DC Film Festival is coming up in November. And Anchorage, Alaska, which, wow, I hope I get to go to that. That would be really cool. It's going to be there. And, you know, what we're hoping for is that somebody like Sundance will pick it up. So we're working on the final project, which will be submitted to Sundance, and then, you know, we see if we go from there. And if it's not accepted there, we'll just put out the final project sooner. Yeah.
And this is a full-length film, and, you know, and people can go and see snippets of it on your website, and they can also sign up for announcements and other kinds of things. Just to sum up here, you know, what
the YouTube channel. The YouTube channel.
Yeah.
We Yeah, we have a lot of clips on the YouTube channel, and we try mm-hmm. to update that, once a month when we're not busy. So you can see a lot of clips that maybe you'll see in the movie or that mm-hmm. maybe you won't. Mm-hmm.
Great. So what has been your experience of, what has making this film, done for you or taught you, or what is your big takeaway from, inquiring into this and making the movie?
It made me tired. I'm about to take off after this and go take my first break in a really long time. To me, this has just been the experience of my entire life. If I... not to be morbid, but, God forbid, if I should die after this film is done, I will feel like, okay, my purpose was served.
Mm-hmm.
Everything in my life, I feel, has built me to make this film somehow.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that doesn't sound weird, but it means everything to me. It's what I've been wanting to do for the past 15 years, and I just feel a great sense of satisfaction that I've done it, and I hope that it reaches people and that people like it and, can get something out of it, and I really hope that it can spark more than a conversation. I hope it can start a wave. I hope it can start a sea change.
I hope so, too. I hope so, too. And I can see it doing that, and I hope that happens. So, thank you so much, documentary filmmaker Jen Senko, for being with me this week on Connect the Dots. Check in at her website, The Brainwashing of My Dad, and look forward to that wonderful film that's a work in progress, almost complete. Thank you so much for your terrific work on this really important topic, Jen, and I hope your wishes for it come true, and lovely having you here as a guest, and we'll have you back.
Oh, thank you so much, Allison, and thanks for what you do, too.
Thanks. You're welcome. I have to. It's like that's the way it is. Thank you, listeners, for being with us for this edition of Connect the Dots. We'll be back with you again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Be well. Stop, go.